Hey, welcome to The Look Back, my pandemic podcast, or hopefully post-pandemic podcast, broadcasting here from the basement of Newman Media Studios. My name is Keith Newman, and I'm the host of The Look Back. And this is a place where we have some fun conversations with old friends, a few newsmakers, and some rule breakers, all in the name of sharing insights and experiences along with a little bit of levity and fun. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and if you're so inclined, or perhaps even open to some bribery, you'll share this podcast with some friends who might also enjoy it. This episode is sponsored by Estrella, the blockchain-powered cap table and shareholder management platform that allows executives to manage and leverage their company's equity as a recruitment and retention tool, as well as a resource to enhance company culture. Estrella meets all of your shareholder management needs, along with the highest level of customer service and at the best price. Ask to speak with an equity expert or get a demo today of Estrella at Estrella, Estrella.com. Let's go on to the show. All right. Well, Keith Fox, welcome to The Look Back.
Well, thank you for having me. Good to see you again.
Part two. Okay. First, I gotta go ahead and take care of some business here. The elephant in the room, your UConn Huskies defeated my San Diego State Aztecs in the men's college basketball finals last week. And we had a little back and forth there. Congratulations. I mean, a fantastic season for both teams, but San Diego State definitely met their match. Those Huskies were a powerful team. Congratulations on your
well, thank you. I'm glad you brought it up first, because I certainly was going to bring it up.
I knew you would.
Living here in San Diego now, I've been watching them all year and you know, last couple of years, and their program has been great and will be for years to come. I mean, so they will get back there. Actually, in my selection, I had them go into the top eight, and a lot of people were in my group were like, "What?" And I said, "They got a great team." I didn't have them going all the way to the finals, but I had them going a long way.
And, well, I hope you have a chance to go watch them in person down there in San Diego, and maybe get a championship back on the West Coast. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. But I honestly, UConn's team, a lot of those guys are young, but most of them are coming back. So they got a powerhouse there.
It's hard to repeat, but hard to count them out too. I'm sure they'll be rated high.
Yeah, it just tells you the importance of leadership and coaching. Danny Hurley's been there 5 years now. He had to rebuild, you know, some things, and he's done a wonderful job. And same with the program at San Diego. I mean, it starts with leadership. So they really, both programs are terrific. It's great to see.
Yeah. I could talk about basketball
all hey, yeah, likewise. I'm a
geek on now for my NBA team as well. But we'll talk about that some other time. I'm excited to chat with you because you and I shared so many great stories, memories back when we were forgot to turn that off though. so many great memories from when we were back in the Apple days and you were running a division there, the head of what was the actual division?
They called it the consumer group, the way Apple was organized at that time. You know, there were a lot of different organizational structures, but what you're referring to is the Macintosh Performa group. It started in Apple USA. And if you recall, we were, you know, basically under assault from Windows. That was a tough period in time in Apple's history. And we were losing developers, you know, so we really needed a strategy to, you know, get some volume up, keep our developers on the platform. And we were transitioning, you know, processors. we were building out the OS. Microsoft was catching up, obviously, with Windows. So that was a tough period of time for Apple. So I was asked to to lead a group that basically, you know, created a product line that would get us back into retail and target consumers, specifically leveraging our strength in education. So we created a product line called the Macintosh Performa, and it was the first time, you know, we went to mass retail in a long time. You know, last mm-hmm. time we were there was Apple II and Apple IIc days. And so, you know, we bundled software, we targeted families of school-age children, was the target market, trying to get first-time buyers, and leverage our strength in the K-12 school area. So that worked, you know, you know, we went from zero to $1 billion product line in 3 years. Then it was taken where it made sense internationally as well. Other countries kind of followed that strategy.
What was that? What was the one or two things, Keith, that you recall that turned it around for you? Because was it, you know, getting the product where the customers wanted to buy it? Was it something in the technology or in the software relationships? I know it's a confluence, of course, but was there one or two things? Was it on the team side?
So I mean, it was a little bit of all those things. I think, as you know, I help teach entrepreneurship now at the University of Connecticut. It started with a program at Cal Poly called Innovation Quest, and you know, we teach the fundamentals of creativity, innovation, entrepreneurial thinking, which is foundational in pretty much every business person.
Yeah.
And so we had an idea, you know, we had to see if that idea had value or we could create value with that idea. And then we had to capture that value. So again, we wanted to reach first-time buyers. And we wanted to obviously, you know, keep developers on our platform. Without developers, you know, and solutions, you don't really have a business in at that time in the personal computer business. And I would argue the same is true now with iPhones and smartphones. You know, obviously, you know, we had profitability objectives, cash flow objectives. So, you know, it was a confluence of things that came together. You know, like any business, you know, products come and go, but the brand is the essence of the staying power. So one of the problems Apple had was that the Apple brand had not been invested in a long time. You know, mm-hmm. that people confused Macintosh with Apple, the brand. And so what we attempted to do was, you know, with packaging, you know, colors, full colors, we went with a full bundle, you know, making sure people knew it was an Apple product into retail where you don't have consultative salespeople. You know, I mean, it was, you know, more of a, the packaging had to do a lot of work. You know, we had, you know, part-time people helping the folks in retail, you know, with, you know, displays.
Plug and play. You were going for plug and play, and it was a unique time at Apple.
Yeah. And if you recall, Microsoft had an ecosystem where Dell was, you know, basically selling direct to previous buyers, if you will. So a lot of corporations were buying Dells because they knew what they wanted. And, you know, that was, you know, basically a catalog, if you will, approach to the install base. Packard Bell, you know, developed and others, you know, trying to go after first time buyers through retail. So the Performa was up against Packard Bell and others trying to get to that customer set. Apple had gone direct to K-12 education with our K-12 program. We had gone direct with stores at the university level. You know, we had a fledgling national account direct program and a fledgling OEM program where we, you know, sold to, you know, vertical market, you know, OEMs. So again, the Performa was targeting first-time buyers in the home, and you know, it was very complicated. It just it was, but we accomplished the objective.
Right. No, it was it was amazing, and we won't even go into what was going on in the corporate gamesmanship. But it's funny to think, if you separated the product from the brand, how would that product do in the marketplace? And it's a pretty obvious story. It would be an uphill battle.
Yeah. So again, we leveraged the Apple brand more than the Macintosh brand when we did the Performa.
Yeah.
And then we pioneered some new channel programs for Apple. You know, nobody had ever done a MAP program, you know, at Apple. And
a minimum advertised price that you could sell without everybody getting into a discounting game.
Right. So, and then, you know, we had pioneered and did some staff work, and the team did, around Apple only stores and, you know, all the Apple Center stuff that had been piloted overseas.
Yep.
So I think, you know, we did a good job of laying the groundwork for what ultimately became the iMac.
Yeah.
And the colored iMacs, and then, you know, Apple's transition to creating Apple stores and still being able to do business at retail with products like the iPod.
Yeah. You kind of laid down some genetic code, is what you're saying, Keith.
Yeah. Well, the team did. You know, we had a small team that had a tough assignment. And I'm really proud of everybody that worked on that. And,
well, it's paid off super handsomely over time, both the growth of Apple, the growth of the Mac, growth of the Apple stores. Those were all home runs. The super Trojan horse that doesn't get enough attention even today is the education push, and where Apple's so strong and really built that fertile ground and continue.
Yeah, and that dates back to Apple II days when I was there. You know, I mean, that dates back to you know, creating the what was called the STO program, you know, sales training orientation, and we had a direct price list. A lot of the dealers were trying to sell to schools and notoriously slow pay, and they didn't have the financial wherewithal to have the cash flow, you know, to sell to school, or to government for that matter, if the federal government. So, you know, we pioneered some, you know, when I say we collectively, Apple and the teams, pioneered some really interesting things back in the Apple II days to really get the K-12 market. And then, you know, over time, obviously other Apple products came, you know, Macs and iPod, you know, iPads, and, you know the story. So
I do. And by the way, let's go back and share with the audience a little bit here. How you got to, you know, running this division at Apple is interesting, because you had an interesting start in the world of tech and computers and Apple at a point in time where, you know, today it's sort of obvious with your background where what industries you would go after. Back then, not so obvious to go start a career in tech, but you got started in kind of a unique and interesting way.
Yeah, I did. I think your reference. I did a 20-minute sit down with the president of UConn. It's called the Worth Repeating series, and she was asking me, you know, how did you get into the tech world? And you know, I grew up in Connecticut. My dad was a teacher, and you know, I kind of fell into this. Honestly, I was a business student, and my brother was a year older and had graduated. My dad taught high school industrial arts, you know, shop and electricity. And, you know, I was kind of brought up around gadgets and all that fun stuff. And a good friend of his was a computer science teacher. He had mortgaged his house and opened up one of the first computer stores in the United States. And this is in the 70s, right? So there was no Microsoft. I mean, it was a twinkle in Bill's eye. But there were Apple IIs without disk drives. There were Atari 400s and 800s. And the operating system at the time was CPM. This is pre-MS-DOS. And so the guy's name was Doc O'Shea, and he had a little store down on Route 7 in Norwalk.
What was the name of the store?
It was really clever. The Micro Computer Store.
There you go. They didn't get much more creative for that generation. It was computer land, then business land, then computer factory.
So this was a small independent store. My dad had taught me and my brothers finance. We didn't use our student loan money in college. We, you know, worked. So we had some money, and we basically bought in, my older brother and I, and we became entrepreneurs right out of college with Dr. O'Shea, and we had a little computer store. And, you know, Peachtree Accounting existed, so we sold Peachtree Accounting on CPM on computers that most people will not remember, but things like Dynastar and Vector Graphics and Cremenco and Ohio Scientific. Those were the brands, the microcomputer brands at the time. Apple really was a hobbyist machine at the time. And so people that, you know, wanted to play around and stick cards in the different slots and learn how to program, you could learn to program in BASIC. Microsoft had a interpretive BASIC and a compiled BASIC. You know, Apple had Apple BASIC. They had BASIC, and you could get COBOL with a card on a CPM machine.
Okay, you're getting me way too excited now.
It was fun times. Yeah, I mean, it was very.
So you went from running the computer store, though. What was that transitional step?
I wanted just to have a hobbyist store. I obviously wanted to have a career. So we, you know, politely agreed that I would move on.
Yeah.
I ran into Bob Washburn, who was running the distributor, and Apple bought out all its distributors because they couldn't keep up. And so, we all went to dinner. Bob said, "Hey, if you're leaving," and he looked at Doc, he said, "You mind if Keith comes to work for Apple with me?" And he said, "No, of course not." And he says, "You want to come?" And I said, "Of course."
What a crazy time, though.
Two weeks later, I was up in Boston and working for Apple and for Bob. And John Zeisler was the other guy in the office, if you remember John. And
of course, Z.
Yeah. So we took care of all the computer stores throughout New England, upstate New York. Yeah.
You know, New England was a great territory for Apple for a long time. They had the academic focus and concentration there.
Yeah. So that was Apple II days. And then obviously we were there for the launch of the Mac. And we had a lot of the universities that were the first customers for the Mac. So there was something called the Apple Consortium. There were 24 universities.
Yeah.
And I think we had 12 of the 24 throughout New England and upstate New York and through New York City.
Another fun memory, Keith.
Yeah.
There was the Macworld show that was the hugest thing in the world in San Francisco, but they had a second one and it was in Boston.
Yeah. Our team supported that. And half of home office would fly out, and you know, we had a lot of fun with everybody from California coming out to Boston, and those were the two big shows,
right?
Those you're bringing back a lot of memories. The funny thing is, before Mac, we had a couple other products, right? We had the Apple III, which didn't all do all that well, but that was Apple's attempt to get into business, and it ran VisiCalc better. Because it's bigger, but it didn't do that well. And then we had the Lisa, which was the precursor to the $10,000 version of the Mac. I was lucky enough to work with a company called CompuGraphic. They had big typesetters, and they were one of the few success stories for the Lisa. They actually wrote a product called Lisa Compose. And it was the front end software to their typesetter. So this is before the laser writer, if you remember. But if you wanted high quality output, you had to use a Lisa with their software outputted to their 8400 and 8600 typesetters. And that was a big OEM customer for Apple. And it set the groundwork for desktop publishing. A lot of their fonts were integrated into the Mac OS, and then other typesetting companies started to support
you know, the Lisa, and then ultimately the Mac, and then we did our own laser writer, if you remember that.
Oh, that was a huge product. And I like to drop the name Aldus PageMaker.
Yeah, yeah. So
one of the softwares that I got familiar with back.
So Paul Brainerd. Paul Brainerd was CEO, founder of Aldus, and obviously, you know, his background came from that world of CompuGraphic and, you know, all those companies. So that that was I was lucky enough to, you know, kind of be involved with all that. And it was very educational and a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah. Well, Keith, let's pivot out of Apple, because you've done a whole bunch of other interesting things I want to touch on before you we revert back to talking basketball. Cisco was another run that you transitioned to. Funny to go from Apple to Cisco. Of course, they're two, you know, super successful Silicon Valley brands, but very different spaces that they operate in from a product and technology standpoint, especially back then. How did you go from the world of, you know, desktop publishing and personal computing to high-end communications, networking, and the backbone of the internet?
Yeah, so great question. So when I was in Boston, I ultimately ran the Boston office. So we had, you know, direct salespeople, like I said, to K-12 education, to universities, to large corporations, OEM customers like CompuGraphic. And, you know, as Apple grew, I got there at 70 million. I left at 10 billion. You know, it was a huge run. But when I was in the Boston office, you know, we had a lot of sophisticated customers, especially in the university market, and they had disparate networks. So we had Apple Talk, you know, it was Apple's own networking protocol. And that's how you had Macs talk to laser writers and other Macs. So it was more of a local area network, if you will. And it was a plug and play thing. But we always got pressure from our customers to say, hey, you know, we want our Macs to talk, you know, to other computers. and other networks. So, you know, DECnet and IBM SNA and Novell NetWare were all installed at these universities in different departments. And same with, you know, Aetna and big companies. So our district, our region, was one of the first places a lot of third-party companies wanted to work with. So we actually installed some of the very first Cisco routers into MIT. So they had something called Project Athena, which was their big network. So the Cisco router essentially was a multi-protocol router. It took disparate networks, encapsulated into the internet protocol, IP, and it allowed different devices and different networks to talk together. So that's what a router is. And so my team, my systems engineers, we had a war room. We had all those products so that we showed customers how Macs could talk to various different networks. And so I was educated, let's say, by my customers, you know, the importance of networking and communications. And I took that to, you know, with me to the home office. Yeah. And ultimately, my boss at the time was Bob Puet, and he was on the board at Cisco. And when they were looking for somebody to help John Chambers take Cisco to the next marketing level, they asked if I would help and join. So I got recruited to help John basically move Cisco from a routing company to, you know, the leader of the networking category. So I went and, you know, obviously I accepted the job and I was there for 6 years. We went from 2 billion to 22 billion in 6 years. And we bought 70 companies. And so we had not just routers, but we had switches and firewalls and networking management software. And so any customer, you know, that wanted to get on the internet could turn to Cisco, you know, and have all the products they needed in their network to guarantee, you know, uptime and performance and security and all those fun things. So Cisco today is still, you know, a wonderful company. And
yeah, And yeah. All kudos to your success there and what John Chambers did for the industry. I forget what a Pac-Man player they were in terms of gobbling up other softwares and hardwares and partnerships, and how great they were in the channel space too, and leveraging that indirect sales as a multiplying effect.
Yeah, a funny story there is, so I get there, and having had the Performa experience, Cisco was starting to explore, you know, how they could go down market. You know, they had a very strong enterprise presence with direct sales, but they didn't really have a strong channel presence. And they created this product line called Cisco Pro, and they were basically creating a version of their product and defeaturing it for the channels. And so John, you know, when I get there, he says, "Hey, I really want you to look at this and tell me what you think." And I, you know, investigated it for a while, and I went, "Oh, this isn't good. We need to kill this product line." So I spent my first 6 months at Cisco trying to figure that out, and we did end of life it. And then we put all the weight behind the Cisco brand. And then we just, you know, we created products and channel programs, and we had a great channel group, you know, that got us on the right track. Let's put it that way. And good stuff. Oh, I lost your audio there.
It's a bad internet connection. No, just joking. when I talk about your time at Cisco, was there another great lesson learned there, you know, with such meteoric growth or doing M&A or from a product and marketing standpoint? What was one of the takeaways?
Yeah. So, you know, again, my background in growing up with my dad as a teacher and education and my Apple experience, I think really helped with the growth and acceleration at Cisco. So I was not just responsible, but for marketing, but for training and education. So I had hired groups, you know, people, you know, into that. And we created the Cisco certification program, meaning that our belief was ultimately a brand is a promise of an experience. Any brand is. It's steeped in caring about what you do. Steve Jobs proved that. You have to deeply care about what you do and have empathy for your customers and their challenges. And, you know, we focused on ease of use at Apple, right? And that today is still the essence of the brand. You know, one person, one computer, putting power in the hands of an individual to make them their best. Right. And so we took that philosophy to the network, you know, take a very complicated thing, but make it so people could grok the complication of that and execute on it. And so that really boiled down to having certified people that knew how to design, build, and maintain a network, a small network or as big as complicated a network as a service provider like an AT&T or British Telecom needs to build out. So we invested in software. I won't tell you the exact numbers, but it was millions of dollars. And we created 4 years of curriculum and then donated it to schools, high schools, community colleges.
I love that idea. Yeah.
And then we sold them equipment at cost so that they could use that curriculum and train young people who then could be certified, take a proctored exam, and end up with a Cisco certified network associate certification. And then we had a network professional. We already had something called CCIE, the Cisco Certified Internet Networking Engineer, which was a very, very tough test. Very few people could pass that. And those engineers were our advanced, you know, people to really go in and consult, you know, the biggest customers with the most complex networks. So the lesson learned for me in any brand is making sure that the people buy into what the promise is, and then they're trained to actually deliver that promise. And so our Cisco certifications now, there's over 1 million people Cisco certified in the world.
I was going to say that was such another Trojan horse strategy, getting Cisco certified.
Yeah, yeah. And it's to this day, I mean, if you go to the Cisco website, that's an anchor to their brand.
Yep.
The certification program is in training, independent training partners, and through schools. So you can get certified, you know, very slowly through your, you know, education process, or if you want to pay more, you can go to a training partner and get accelerated learning to get your certification. And, yeah. And so that's, I teach entrepreneurship with some folks at UConn, and we really stress, the importance of getting people on the same page about the mission of your organization. Why do you exist? Getting people to buy into that, and then make sure everybody really is trained and can execute and deliver on their piece of the promise.
Yeah. Well, Keith, one more pivot I want to do as we wrap towards home here. After Cisco, I know you've been involved on the teaching side and consulting side, also working on your one handicap very aggressively. But besides that, you're also involved in this Project Civil Talk, which I just think it deserves some mention as well, because yeah. It's a very important topic, one that I see every day. And yeah. It scares me.
Yeah, yeah. So, thanks for asking about that. As you know, I retired and did a lot of philanthropy, you know, with our private foundation around children's health and pediatric health in particular. So I'll put a plug in for the Hendren Project. It's named after the surgeon that helped our family, and it's for pediatric surgeons around the world. So we have 6,200 surgeons on the service now.
Wow.
In 147 countries. The executive director is a guy named Ray Evergan, does a great job. And we have board members from Boston Children's, Stanford, Philadelphia. So I'm very proud of that work. And it's been very meaningful for the pediatric community. But about 3 years ago, I was talked into actually coming out of retirement by my daughter and some folks, young people I worked with at UConn. And we created a company called Civil Talk. And the North Star was, could we create a service or a company that could help address a lot of the unhealthy discourse, you know, created by some of the social media companies and media companies, and not maliciously, but it just, you know, it was an outgrowth. So reflecting on my career, you know, in the last 30, 40 years, a lot of great things happened, right? The vision of Apple came true. You know, we now all walk around with a personal computer, you know, in our pocket. And the vision of Cisco came true. The internet was built out. And so we live in a world, what I call is the 24/7 world. You know, you can't get away from it. You know, smartphones aren't going away. The internet's not going away. And what we didn't do was we didn't teach people how to live in this new world. So if you think about Gen Z, you know, what's Generation Z refers to the young people that were born between 1997 and 2012. That's the first generation that doesn't know life without a smartphone and the internet. And so if you're a parent trying to parent that child, you were never trained how to parent some young person growing up.
True. Yeah.
And so, you know, reflecting on that, I was like, wow, man, I shouldn't have retired, because I kind of saw this coming. And And so what Civil Talk is it's an ed tech solution. You know, a lot of people think it's a social media service. It's really an ed tech solution service, trying to educate, in particular, young people, college age, high school age students, how to live in this world. And so we position it as a social emotional learning service. You need to learn how to live online and offline in an authentic way. And you need to learn that there are some bad people on the internet, and they are trying to do bad things. And there are a lot of good people who do bad things once in a while. And so what we're teaching is what's called emotional intelligence. Social intelligence, emotional intelligence, being self-aware of your own emotions, being able to regulate those emotions, being socially aware, and developing, you know, empathy for others, learning how to interact in this world. And we just did a pilot at the University of Connecticut. We integrated into a sales management course, and we taught the students, they're all seniors going off to get jobs, about their own emotional intelligence. And, you know, if you haven't logged in and signed up, it's free to go log in and read. It's a verified service. So you need, it's US only. So it's behind the firewall. We use Cloudflare. And it's $2 to verify. So we use Stripe to verify your identity. You have to use your real name. Well, there's a little micro payment system with tokens, but it costs you $2 to verify.
So I know I know it's challenging to get some of these do good things off the ground. What's going to create the lift here?
Yeah. So the acquisition strategy is really universities. So universities will sponsor their students. So actually, as the students join, their logo is on the profile.
Oh, good.
And you know, we're working through that, you know, with UConn. And then if you go in, you'll read the feedback. It's really positive. And if we get it working at UConn, my hope and vision is that, you know, this is replicable to every university. And
I'll share it with San Diego State, Keith.
Yeah. No,
I know. I also know, being a girl dad, there's a lot of pressure on trying to keep things moving and showing progress.
Yeah, yeah, and I've got two daughters, so I totally get it.
Well, that's fantastic. So it's civiltalk.org is the site?
It's .com. It's still an LLC, and you know, we're kind of leaving it open for how we scale. As you can imagine, I've funded most of it, but yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad you could share that, as well as some of these other great stories. What a fun look back, but also a fun look forward at some exciting things. And look, I mean, we joked casually about how many, you know, genes you placed around the, you know, world of Apple and Cisco, and watching what's coming to fruition must be super gratifying.
Oh, it's, you know, everybody's got their life journey, and I wouldn't trade mine, so.
Okay. Well, save me a seat next year for the UConn Aztecs game next year in the finals or something.
That, I hope and pray that would be a lot of fun for a little repeat there.
That would be awesome. Hey, Keith, thanks again for joining us on the Look Back, and we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
All right, buddy. Talk to you.
All right. Be well. Thanks for listening to The Look Back. We do appreciate your support, welcome any feedback, and would love it if you would subscribe to this podcast and even consider sharing it with some of your friends. For more information and other cool info, check us out at NewmanMediaStudios.com.